Hi, folks. My name is Chris, and I'm the artist and co-founder at Explorer Maps.
Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. I have been a number one fan of Chris's art since I first met him in the late 1990s. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Welcome to The Trail Less Traveled, an adventure radio series and podcast dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from around the world in order to take you back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. This episode was recorded on location in collaboration with Explorer Maps. Missoula, Montana is a mecca for outdoor enthusiasts, and each week we will bring you tales of adventure from both near and far, as well as information and inspiration and a few tunes to set the mood. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about our international outreach projects at traillesstraveled.net. And now, here's your host, international expedition guide, conservationist, and yogi, Mandela.
We're sitting in a thatch hut at the most southern tip of Africa with Rashina Ratnam. Rashina is a writer, a producer, an actor, a puppeteer, a narrator, a friend, a partner, a contributing member of her community, and lover of dumplings. Her family origins come from Sri Lanka, but she grew up in South Africa. And so I'm really excited to sit here in the hut, in the bush, while the wind is blowing very strongly outside. We're protected by the thatch around us and a nice cup of Earl Grey tea to hear Rosh's story. This morning, we had ostrich egg for breakfast. Rosh, I just wanted to first say thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me, Mandy. I'm very excited to do this with you. It's been a long time coming.
Rosh, my first question for you is, where did you grow up and how was adventure a part of your childhood?
So, as you mentioned before, my parents are of Sri Lankan origin. My mom was Malay Sri Lankan, my dad was Tamil Sri Lankan, and they already had quite an interesting marriage from the beginning, my father being Catholic, my mother being Muslim, and my grandfather being quite progressive and allowing, quote-unquote, my mother to marry my father outside of religion and ethnic origins, but also to get my mother to work and make her own money before she got married. Because culturally, getting married at the age of 19 was the done thing. And my grandfather was, no, you have to be financially independent. And so that you, when you decide to marry somebody, that you're doing it because you want to share a life, not because you need to, you know. So, yeah, my parents got married. My brother was born in Sri Lanka. And then the civil war broke out in the late kind of 60s, early 70s. There was some violence, and my dad being Tamil and the ethnic group that seemed to be being targeted at that point in time, really feared for him and the family, this little family that he'd just started. And one day his best friend came in, threw a newspaper down on the table and said, they're looking for engineers in Zambia. And back then, they had a job interview. My dad had to drive. He was out working in the jungle in Sri Lanka. And they set up a telephone interview at the post office on Thursday at 3:30 p.m. My dad drove across and they took the call and my dad got the job. And my parents basically left Sri Lanka. They weren't allowed to take a lot of money out with them, but they smuggled, they did black market, stole some stuff and stuffed money into their socks. And left to Africa, this continent my dad had only seen in the National Geographic. And if I think about it, I think, like, what courage it took to leave this land, but to do it for the love of his family, you know. So, yeah, my dad started working for the government in Zambia, in the copper mines in Zambia. And I was born in 1976 in the town called Luancha. And then we moved to Ndola and then to Lusaka. I only have memories of Lusaka. I remember it just being fertile, like lots of fruit trees in the backyard, like pale yellow sunshine, warm, walking to the library with my brother, watching movies and drinking like thick orange juice and having like a Amari biscuit cookie while you're watching that. I remember like long scratchy socks with the lace at the top and like really shiny shoes that my mom used to dress me up in. I remember being really close friendships, and like I had a close friend, his name was Andrea van Schalkwyk. He was half Italian and half South African. And they grew rabbits and ate them. And it was the first time I was like, you can eat rabbits as food? Because we used to play with them, and one day all the rabbits were gone. And I was like, where are they? And he was like, oh no, we ate them. It was quite a big shock for me. But my friendships, they were really happy. I remember them being really happy. And then my dad got an interview to come work down in South Africa. And I remember the conversation kind of shifting, like obviously overhearing stuff because they never really talked to us directly, about my dad going, oh, I was afraid to know which toilet I could use when he flew down for the interview. And I didn't know like what I should do and if I was allowed to. And for me at that age, I was about seven, eight. I was like, my dad was frightened of something, which turned out to be apartheid, you know. And so we moved down. My dad got the job working for the government. And so we moved down to a place called Bophuthatswana, which was basically one of the homelands in South Africa. They had five different homelands based on the ethnic groups of those homelands or the tribal denominations of those homelands. So Bophuthatswana was for the Tswana people. They had Transkei, Ciskei, and Venda, if I remember it clearly. And these were tiny little patches of land, the least arable, crappiest pieces of land, where black people could own property and quote-unquote govern themselves with puppet presidents, basically. And Bophuthatswana was broken up into seven different pieces. So you would go, if you were riding in your car, Bop roads were really bad. They'd be like, go, 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 with lots of potholes. And then you'd hit South Africa and it'd be like really smooth. And then you'd hit Bop, which would be go, 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 go. So they were, and it was a really bizarre concept that we came into. But when we moved to Bop, apartheid didn't exist in this homeland system that we had gone into. And so, I would say, if I look back on it now, a very pleasant, safe, bubbled childhood. I went to a school, a multiracial school, mostly black kids, whose parents were highly educated or had moved there because they were looking for highly educated people in Bophuthatswana, and who were running away from, you know, the political system. Or who were in interracial marriages and couldn't actually be married to a person of different color in South Africa, so they would come to Bophuthatswana. And so I went to a really great school, had a great education, really also great friends. Adventure, I mean, like for me, would be like, I mean, I was sneaking out of the house. Sneaking out of the house, running up. We had one hotel that had like a bar that we would like go hang out and dance with, but I wasn't doing any, there were no drinking or drugs or anything like that. That was a big thing. Yeah, so that was, so I grew up in Bop, and then when I matriculated, I came down to UCT, and that's where I studied drama. And that would, I would say, would be the beginning of my quote-unquote adulthood at the time. But yeah, that would be adventure. It's an interesting thing you talk about, what means adventure, and I think about you and what you do, right? So when you say adventure to me, I think also like mountain climbing, skiing, river rafting, all of those things. For me, adventure is something that takes me out of my comfort zone, okay? And it can be adventurous to try a different meal. It can be adventurous to speak up, stand up, confront, but also indulge or explore. I think because my parents were refugees and because, well, for running from the Civil War, I was always told, like, don't rock the boat. Don't rock the boat. You fly under the radar. You say thank you. You say yes, please. That's what you do, you know. So I still think I carry a lot of fear in relation to standing out too much or taking risks. It takes me quite a bit of girding of my loins to jump out and seize the day. on some fronts. But then on the other hand, people might look at me and kind of go, oh, you're a performer. You know, I perform in front of thousands of people, you know, shooting things or live. And I don't feel afraid in those spaces. But I know some people who that would be their worst fear. So I guess it's like, for me, adventure, my idea around adventure is definitely, now that I'm older, is around pushing the boundaries around my comfort, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe learning something new. And sometimes that's something not, like, for instance, how to poach an egg. You know, I still don't know how to poach an egg, but like, for me, that's on my list of like things to do. Yeah. And it's exciting because how do you learn to do that, you know, but also like how to do a headstand or something like that. Yeah.
That's the voice of Roshina Ratnam, and we are sitting here under a thatch hut at the most southern tip of Africa. I wanted to ask you, Rosh, about being a refugee in this day and age. Mm-hmm. Just a little insight for people listening.
Mm. I mean, it's so interesting now, especially with like Syria and other places like that. And we were talking about the walk, that giant puppet, Little Amal, who walked the route that refugees walk from Syria to London. And this idea of people having to leave their homes for fear of death, economic fear, taking the risk of death to flee death, fleeing death and taking the risk of death, right? Because there's nothing guaranteed. And my dad had a story where he was riding on a train and the rebels got onto the train. And he was sharing a cabin with a friend of his dad. My dad being Tamil, his friend's dad being Sinhalese, and his friend's dad gave him a Sinhalese newspaper, which has different writing to Tamil newspaper, different writing. They said, read this. And so my dad held up the newspaper over his face, and the rebels came in, and they opened the door, and they looked around, and they saw my dad reading the Sinhalese newspaper, and they moved on. But they were macheting people to death on this train. They were hacking them to death. And my dad looked out the window and he saw a man who had been hit on the head with his eyeball popping out. And that's when the decision to leave. He knew that that was coming close. And we've had family who had lost, burnt houses burnt down. We've got friends who had a corner patch where they would just throw the bodies and burn them for days and days and days. And his daughter, like years later, they went to a buffet where they were cooking stir-frying stuff and the flames were flying up. And she completely had a post-traumatic stress reaction to it. She couldn't, it just took her back. And I look at my parents and the risk that they took to leave at that point in time. And I think about, my father always said, we are here due to the grace of our host country, you know. And so it's an interesting thing also what I've learned, that never mind refugee, but also a lot of immigrants tend to become quite insular. They stay culturally, stay together, intermarry, food, language, all of those things, which I think is very important. But my father always said, how can you go to another man's country and not invite that man to your table? And I knew some other, you know, families who had come along with us who didn't have Zambian friends or African friends or people of a different color. They knew other Sri Lankans, and those are the people that they invited in. So for me, traveling and making life in another place for a better life, and more often because of your children, right? You want, most people would do it for a better life for their kids than they had, but at great risk and a great loss. And my father was a qualified engineer, my mom was a secretary. He left behind what he knew. He left his culture, he left his friends, because he wanted better. He gained a lot, but I also know that he lost a lot. He had a dream that he would go back and retire, like a dream that he held on to for a long time. And one of our last trips that we took together, he was like, no, I'll come back and retire in Sri Lanka. And he had gone off to try and negotiate a taxi for us, and he would told us, my brother and I, go stand in the corner, because if they see you, they're going to triple the price. Because we don't look like quote-unquote normal Sri Lankans. Mm-hmm. And even when, with my father on his own, they could sense that he wasn't from there. And they wouldn't lower the price of the taxi. And he was so heartbroken by that. He was like, they're trying to cheat me, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, because he had fundamentally changed. Mm-hmm. And as much as he, I think, had an idea that he was Sri Lankan through and through, I think Africa had become so much of who he was and his system and his identity, that he realized that actually Sri Lanka wasn't going to be the place where he was going to die, you know. And that's a loss. This idea, the dream. Some people can have the ability to get places where they are welcomed and transitioned quite relatively painlessly. I don't think it's ever painless. But not as... And there's some places where the trauma just gets re-traumatized, right? We don't want you to get away. And here in South Africa, we have a terrible system of that, right? Somalian shops being burnt down. There was a thing, actually, one of the very first, I think, anti-immigrant kind of violence that we had, they were running around, vigilantes were running around and trying to get people to say the word for elbow in isiXhosa, which is inqeniba, which I'm probably not saying properly myself. But if you are a foreign person and you can't get that click right, they would beat you to death over the fact that you could not say the word elbow. It's frightening how we other people, how we test. Mm. You don't look like me, you don't sound like me. Mm. And our fear and hate of the other, right? Hatred stems from fear, right? You're taking something that I want. You have something I want. Or I don't want you to have. Something like that. It's terrifying. Yeah. I don't know what else to say about that.
Rosh, I wanted to talk about apartheid.
You know, people go, oh, I didn't realize anything about race until I was... I didn't. You know, growing up in Zambia, I didn't. And it was only, as I mentioned before, hearing my dad not know which toilets he could use at the airport on his way to the job interview that I realized. And it's interesting that the image of the boogeyman for me was a large white moustached khaki wearing person. That person represented the politicians, the people who could make you disappear in the middle of the night, who could hurt your father, you know, and in turn hurt us. Yeah, so growing up in Mafeking was like supposedly like all fine and proper, but then we'd have things like there was an all-white school in the middle of the town, Mafeking High, which was considered South African land. So strange. I think about it. So the rest of the country land around Mafeking High was Popotetswana, but South African laws function, so that's why it could be an all-white school. So the white farmers and everybody could bring their kids in there. Everybody else got to go to a mixed school. And it's such an interesting thing, that early age, and I still do it now, and it's something that I find a lot of my generation of South African, I racialize stuff. So when people talk to me about, hey, you know, Sam went down to the beach to go swimming today, I'd be like, oh, Sam the white guy? You know? That's the way I talk. And a lot of people my generation do the same. And once I have the race, I'm like, okay, that's fine. It's a really weird thing in how I compartmentalize things. Not that it bothers me. I don't know. And it's definitely from the way that I was raised around that. I still carry that very much around entering spaces nowadays in Cape Town, even though it's quite a supposedly cosmopolitan city, is not as cosmopolitan as Johannesburg. Like, I'm very aware when I walk into space and I'm the only brown person there sitting at a table except for the people that are serving. I've just become hyper aware of that, you know, of all the time, like even down to what I watch and what I read. I'm like, who are these people? Why is that person of a particular race getting to tell this story? Why am I only seeing this particular kind of person telling this story? Where is my story? And when I do see someone who looks like me or sound like me, I'm like, oh, catch a breath. You know, it's like a breath of fresh air. We as a country have been colonized for over 300 years. Apartheid existed for over 40, 50 years. And you have people nowadays who are like, oh, but we've been independent for 20 years. Why are you still carrying it? You need to get over it. Because the systemic damage that has been done, we are not even, if we're talking about in terms of our growth, we're not even toddlers yet. We're still in this embryonic stage of our identity of as a country. And yes, there have been people who've robbed and stolen and all these kind of things. I'm not saying there's definitely mistakes have and continue to being made, Crimes are being committed outright against South Africans as a whole. But if we come back to this show that I was talking about, one of the shows that we're talking about, this idea of being able to name your feelings, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing the show based for South African children of between 2 and 4 years old, a puppetry show around mental health, because a large segment of our population, mental health is not even something that's talked about or even had a name for. Therapy, there are ways of doing it. Like, I think, you know, there are people that can become traditional healers, that can kind of become, there are ways of connecting or grounding oneself spiritually in order to kind of process some of these things. But millions of people don't have access to that. And so what happens is that this re-traumatization continues generation to generation to generation. And how do we stop it? How do we stop the shame of our own skin color, of our own gender, of our own where we stand in the pyramid of things? Because even though black people in South Africa are the majority of the people, economically, they're still the smallest kind of echelon of earnings in the country. That shift has not happened yet, you know? It's getting better, education-wise, sometimes, some way, somehow, slowly. But how this people think that just because something ends, or, you know, Nelson Mandela was free and all of these things, that, oh, Rainbow Nation, but there's so much damage. And still profound racism that exists not only between white and black people, but within, like, colored and black people, Indian and black people and white people. Like, it goes, there's so much, like, they are like this, like, they are like that, you know. We don't do this. Oh, none of my people, you know. Oh, well, my... And then this idea of... now, you know, we're introducing people, Zimbabwean people, from Southern Africa, from all over Africa, actually, who are coming in. Mozambican, Zimbabwean, you know, Angolan, Nigerian. There's resistance and prejudice amongst that, you know. It's interesting because if I look at our kids... And I look at our oldest. He definitely is like, I don't see, you know, he's moved on to a space of like, he's a little more, less caught up about that stuff. And then he went to university at Stellenbosch, and being a young black man, experienced being profiled basically every single day. He got stopped 5 to 6 times. Who are you? Where are you going? Who are you? Where are you going? Show me your ID. And it was the first time after living in Cape Town and being kind of quite protected for a while that he was like, jeez. Why can't I move through the space, you know, and being profiled by other people who look like him. Mm. Right. So this system of, it's a very strange thing. It's a very strange thing. But hopefully, as we said, this is how we have to become the change we want to see in the world. Right.
Rosh, you mentioned your project that you're working on, and you mentioned puppets, and so that's a huge part of your life.
Yeah.
You're a producer, you're a writer, you're an actress, you're a puppeteer, you're a narrator. I'd like to talk to you about your work. You did mention studying acting in South Africa, but can you tell us about your journey into one of your biggest passions now, which is puppetry, and it's taken you all over the world?
Yeah. So I studied drama at UCT, and I started acting for a while. And then I went over to South Korea to teach English there for a bit. And when I came back, I directed and I've worked with, and I have a very close and profound relationship with, Jacqueline Domisa. Was doing a production of a show called Sadako Sasaki, which is based on the real-life story of a Japanese girl who survived the bomb in Hiroshima, but who died of leukemia and basically became a warrior of peace. And she folded origami cranes. It's a very beautiful story. So Jacqueline wanted to do this show, and she amazingly got the funding to build some amazing bunraku puppets. Bunraku puppetry is a form of Japanese puppetry where three puppet manipulators move a single body of a puppet. You have the head puppeteer, which has the mechanism on the head, and depending if they're right or left-handed, I'm right-handed, so my right hand would manipulate the head, and my left hand would hold the left hand of the puppet. You would then have a puppeteer on the feet of the puppet and a person on the right hand of the puppet and someone holding the pelvic area to basically keep the puppet in line and holding it up straight. This is the first time I'd ever touched puppetry, ever before. I was trained by a lovely gentleman called Jason Portita, who worked for Handspring Puppet Company, and they are an amazingly famous South African puppet company. And I always say to people, the thing I love about puppets is that your ego goes out the window. That you, in order to be the best puppeteer, you are in service to the puppet. And when there are three people trying to make one object live, and you can only communicate through in-breaths and out-breaths, and you basically have a thousand-yard stare to be aware of who's moving where, when they're moving, when you can go, when you can stop, when something's looking, it is an incredibly complex human machine, human body. It's basically three bodies coming together to make one inanimate object body work. And the other thing that I love about puppetry is that you can use... It's difficult to watch an adult play a child because it can sometimes become a little bit over the top. You know, sometimes... Jacqueline Domisa said the director, like this idea that, hey, kids, this is what we're going to do today. Like a little bit, like a little too loud, a little bit too much, a little too in your face. And for me, often, I grew up with very kind of educational kind of children's theatre or fable based theatre, and you know, telling the story. And children's theatre now, or what we now call theatre for young audiences, is moving into a completely different space. There is theatre created for babies as young as a month old, where the mums come into a tent and they watch a show with their month old that's literally five babies in a tent with lights and music and touch and sound, where it's an experiential kind of experience. So what I love about puppets with the age group, our company's called An Art Theatre, and we have puppets that represent the kids. And firstly, as we come back, I was mentioning before in the previous thing about representation. When I was growing up in South Africa, I didn't see myself on TV. And this idea to have a young black protagonist child be the leader in their own story, be have agency, make their own choices, create their own adventure through this inanimate object that looks like them and is even smaller than them and sometimes even maybe the same size as them. And kids are amazing at forgetting that there's a puppeteer manipulating a puppet.
It was while we were living internationally, about 11 years ago, that Explorer Maps first started, when Chris and his brother Greg decided to join forces and bring the maps to the whole wide world. Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. Each map is a labour of love, and I am lucky enough to see them all grow step by step from the early research and planning stages onto a large white piece of paper, through penciling, inking, and finally seeing the real magic happen as Chris adds the colour. As each one reaches the end phase, I get to examine them closely in the hope that I spot any unfinished bits before Chris sends them off. But there's always new illustrations to see every time. I love going to the Missoula warehouse when we're in Montana to see each unique map on the incredible range of products that Explorer Maps now has. Having lived away from home and families for the past 17 years, our aim of connecting people and place is very poignant to me. And for that reason, my favourite maps are Flathead and the Maasai Mara, because these two places are central to our extended family gatherings and where we have made the best of memories. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Today, the trail less traveled is being recorded just 100 footsteps away from the Indian Ocean. We are almost at the most southern tip of Africa, surrounded by fynbos, sand dunes, bushveld, rolling hills, and then farmlands. The closest town, dorp, is about, I don't know, an hour away because you have to drive on the rough road to get there. And I'm sitting here with Roshina Ratnam. Rosh. So I was wondering if there's any chance that you could describe the structure you're in and what you see when you look out the window.
I am currently sitting in a thatch hut with a double barn door that's closed because there is a howling southeaster wind outside. One thing I love about San Sebastian is I always talk about the luxury. It's a place that very few people come to get to visit and experience. It is on the mouth of the Davenhawks River, and it goes out into the Indian Ocean. So when you walk down out the house and you walk down the cobbled pathway built by Mandela's grandma, she'd make the kids bring home big rocks from the sea, flat rocks. Had to be flat, otherwise you'd trip and fall. You hit the sand, and on your left-hand side, you have really big sand dunes with some really big bushes on them. And as you carry on for another 2 or 3 minutes, you hit the river mouth. And either the tide is going in or the tide is coming out. And if you're really lucky, you'll get there when it's hanging in between. But either way, on a good day or a bad day, you can jump in and go out to sea, or you can jump in and go into the river. And as you go around the corner and you look out onto the Indian Ocean, it is a deep, dark navy blue, usually capped with lots of white choppy waves. You can see the horizon as far as you can see. It feels like you're sitting in a snow globe, because when you look around, you can see the horizon going all the way around you. And to the left, you will see Witzand, which is the largest big city, which is about a 2-hour drive away from here. But the beach stretches on for miles and miles and miles. And sometimes you can go for days without seeing another human being.
Rosh, I'd like to continue talking to you about puppets. So the trail has traveled. One of my intentions is storytelling.
Yeah.
I feel like puppets have been a part of storytelling for a very long time.
Yeah.
We don't need to go into the history of it, but can you tell us a little bit about what you've learned about puppets and different approaches to it and the stories they've told in the cultures that you've studied them in as you continue to travel the world studying and sharing puppetry?
One of the things is that I'm desperately keen to keep on learning about puppets. As you said, like, puppets have been around. It's an ancient storytelling form. Shadow puppetry. In Asia, there's water puppetry. There's in Europe, marionette puppets are very much part of the zeitgeist in terms of children's theatre. Mm-hmm. It's amazing in Europe, like every single town, especially in Eastern Europe, has a dedicated theatre to puppets only, you know, where like they have a company and like set makers and designers. And I've been very lucky that I've managed to kind of travel to these places and see what's being done out there in relation to that. Africa, I know we have the Malian tradition of puppetry, giant puppets, but not as ancient at all in terms of compared to some other parts of the world, puppetry. And often when I talk to people, when I say that I'm a puppeteer, people will instantly think of Sesame Street. They will think of the Muppets. It's a glove puppet, or what we would like to call a hand puppet. Sock puppet, something with eyes on. You can even make a puppet. There's a company that you can literally buy little round googly eyes, mm-hmm. slip them onto your hand, and your hand itself becomes the mouth. Like your thumb is the bottom jaw, and your four other fingers at the top. Super simple to make a talking puppet. And there's some incredible people doing some amazing puppetry. Giant puppets, you know, fire-breathing dragons and panthers and all sorts of amazing things. And I think what people don't realise is that puppetry is actually, as we were talking about, very much part of a lot of films that we watch. Not everything is actually CGI. Often puppets or live or objects have a much more visceral, live authenticness to them than a CGI creation could ever have. We were talking about Jurassic Park being one of those movies that was a combination of CGI and puppets and people in suits. So storytelling, for me, you know, what's so interesting is this idea that initially, like, a lot of the time we think of puppetry for kids and we think of Punch and Judy. But now that we know that Punch and Judy are actually quite a violent, it's quite a violent relationship that happens between partners. You know, he beats her, she beats him. There's and this idea that violence can be funny. And actually what I've learned is that at a particular age group, violence is funny. You know, we might think, oh, that's quite inappropriate. But kids at a certain age, when someone falls over or hurts themselves, laugh. Mm-hmm. Not because they're in essentially mean or wanting to harm somebody, but there's definitely a thing developmentally where kids, it's the toilet humor. If you put a fart in any show, you will get a good laugh. If you get somebody falling over or somebody hurting themselves, you always get a good laugh. So that idea of children's theatre and entertaining kids has been very much part of, like, how puppetry, like, in, especially in Europe and places like that. In Asia, very much community coming together at nighttime. Mm-hmm. The shadow puppets, the telling of the religious stories, you know, the creation of the earth, or, you know, all those kind of things that we do. The coming together, sharing of the oral history. What I happen to have kind of gotten into is the notion of puppetry for adults, right? Handspring Puppet Company built the horses for Warhorse, but have done some incredible productions of their own, Wojciech on the High Felt, Ubu and the Truth Commission, and, you know, Jenny Young as well, productions who I work with as well, just done some incredible, Roboros. This idea of storytelling for adults using objects to tell story, that it's not as, it can be as profound, as delicate, as transporting as a film, you know, or any other form of theatre. And the latest production that I'm in at the moment, The Life and Times of Michael Kay, which is a combination of live actors, Bunraku puppets, and backdrop film taking place in the Karoo, so that we watch the puppet walk through the landscapes, really kind of comes together to create this full, rounded, complex, vulnerable story. So it's really, for me, always interesting when I see people, especially people that have no idea or have a preconceived idea what puppet shows are, and then coming to watch something kind of going, "Phew, that was not what I expected," you know. And more often than not, I really think that a puppet can tell and say and do things. The other thing that I worked at, now that I've just completely forgotten, was at ZA News, or ZA News, which is a political satire program where I was on it for, I worked with them for 5 years, but they were around for much longer. And they worked with Zapiro, who used to draw the caricatures, and he's still a cartoonist, a satire cartoonist. And they made puppets of Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu. And eventually we started doing a lot of local South African political satire and international. So we had presidents of all countries. We had, you know, we had Donald Trump, we had Hillary Clinton, we had Barack Obama, we had Tony Blair, we had, you know, like, different presidents and politics. And puppets can get away with saying things that no human being can get away with. There's an amazing comedian called Conrad Koch, who has a puppet called Chester Missing. Conrad's an incredible political, understands politics and is quite, you know, pushes buttons and gets, like, can have discussions with politicians using Chester Missing as the quote-unquote interviewer. And Chester can say things directly to the face of a politician that Conrad would never been able to get, would ever be able to get away with, you know. And that's the power of puppetry, is that, and they can bring change. They can push buttons, they can create conversation, they can be bawdy, they can be funny and very slapstick, without, you know, so really an incredible way to... They have a program in Kenya called XYZ that is similar and still running and runs on national television. And they can make change. They create, you know, people are like, oh, that politician was saying that he was going to do this and look what he's doing now. Look at the new house that he has or whatever mm-hmm. the hell, you know, the thing is going on right now. It's an incredibly powerful platform to use to keep people accountable, you know. So on one hand, people kind of go, ha, 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 puppets, but they can be very, very powerful.
That's the voice of Rashina Ratnam, and we're talking about some of the elements of her career as a professional puppeteer, writer, narrator, actress, and contributor to her community. And that's what I want to talk with you next. Contributing to the community, mm-hmm. you have changed the lives of a lot of people. And I just want to talk to you a little bit about that and the stages in life where you've come to this stage now. And you've been here for a while where you give back to mm-hmm. your community and like your father said, the country that took you in when he couldn't be safe in the country where you and your mother came from.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very much my idea of giving and sharing is definitely stemmed from my parents. My mother always carried like basically a spare change purse, you know, and we couldn't stop every single traffic light. It was always like, oh, shame. My parents would contribute to the old age home. They would contribute, you know, to the SPCA. They would contribute to the orphanages. And my dad was a slightly kind of a religious man. He had a very complicated relationship with God, but was so grateful for the life that he had that he knew that he had to give back, that it's a circular cycle thing, right? And I'm an artist, and you and I talked about this. So we're both freelancers. We both, like, travel the world. We're, like, the way I move through the world is very feast or famine and can be quite tenuous, you know. And so I know for a lot of people that's not a life that they could ever begin to lead, but it's the only life I know how to live, living on that edge. Things have got a lot better, and I feel definitely a lot more grounded than I did initially when I started off in... acting and performing. I definitely feel a lot more grounded, and it comes with age, it comes with more regular work. And even though I don't have a lot, I always know that I have more than other people, right? So, I mean, how do I contribute to my community? I contribute, firstly, you know, I work for an organization called UNIMA South Africa, which is the South African puppetry chapter of a global organization of puppets. And my community that I'm passionate about is puppeteers, puppeteers of color, puppeteers in all over the country. How do we get together? How do we share? How do we support? How do we learn new things? Because often as artists in South Africa, we work by ourselves. We're constantly struggling to get funding. We work from project to project. It's not for the faint-hearted, the idea of being a freelancing artist at all. In most places in the world, but in South Africa, very much so. COVID has made it even more so. We had people in our community who were literally starving during lockdown. Literally starving. And so that idea of contributing to my community is not just about, it's very much about sharing what we have. What have we got? You've got that, you've got this. And, you know, we've got an incredible amount of young people now that we've trained up who have a real passion for puppets. And 10, 15 years ago, those people weren't around. And to like build on that and that constantly is going forward. So the people that we train other people, train kids, do shows, are constantly going out, putting it out into the world and inspiring and uplifting other artists and kids, educating but entertaining, providing a safe space, even if it's for half an hour in a day. But I think the big thing for me that's really shifted was working with Rockpa International and UNIMA South Africa during lockdown. We basically got together and did some food parcels for over 100 families. And it was really then that I realized I may not have money to contribute, but what I do have is time. And what I can do is drive my car to buy the stuff in order to get it to the place where the people can work and make money from the stuff. What I can do is contribute the fact that I have access to the internet and can apply for stuff. I can make sure that people have data when they need data, can make the calls when they need calls, that they know that they need help, that I can be the person that kind of, that can be the communicator of trying to hold things in space, you know. But that's also teamwork, right? And there's a core team of people who are passionate about the community, passionate about the arts, passionate about uplifting, keeping the community safe and healthy. It's an interesting thing. What is that guy's... is it Maslow's hierarchy of needs? That's it, right? And this idea of food and shelter. And so what we've done now is like food, shelter, work, all of those things. But what we're really seeing now, and we come back to this notion, is again about mental health and how much our community needs to be supported mental health wise. There's a lot of addiction in the communities, our community. There's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of cyclical violence. There's a lot of economic abuse. You know, I have the money, you have to do this because I'm paying you. Or if you want to eat, you have to go, you know, this kind of stuff. And so what we're trying to do is, that's our next step, hopefully moving forward in this coming year, is try and introduce that into the community. And not only to help, but maybe also train people to become counselors so that they can stay in their communities and be there, as opposed to bringing people in. At the moment, we're going to have to bring people in. Such a cliche. But it's a thing I hold on to. You have to be the change that you want to be see in the world, right? I've traveled the world, and this idea of, if I go overseas, things are better, there are more money, you know, America or, you know, the UK or Europe. But having traveled, my heart is here. My passion is here. Every country has their troubles. I always call it every country has their own dumpster fire of stuff, you know. And I look at the US and I look at the UK and I'm like, you all have your own problems. I don't care about those problems because they're not problems that sit close to me. People will look at South Africa and kind of go, oh my God, I could never live there. But I am passionate about this place. It is my home. It is my identity. It is my breath. It is who I see myself to be. And if I want things to get better, I need to start doing something about it, right? And we start, I'm not going to maybe change millions of lives, but if I can change one life, and that one life makes a difference to one other life, that in and of itself is enough for me, you know? And that, I hope, will continue to grow and from strength to strength as we make more friends around the world.
Namaste, Missoula. Mandela here, your host of The Trail Less Traveled. Thank you so much for your support and for listening to The Trail Less Traveled, which is The Trail 103.3's locally harvested adventure radio series. The show premieres every Sunday evening at 6 Mountain Time, and you can stream it live online at trail1033.com. If you miss the premiere, the show is also a podcast, which is available everywhere. I would like to end the show by extending gratitude to a small family business based in Missoula, Montana, who recently partnered with the Trail Less Traveled in order to connect people and place. That small family business is Missoula's very own Explorer Maps. Explorer Maps has over 60 hand-drawn story maps. They donate a percentage of everything sold back to the conservation of these public lands. That's it for this week's adventure, my friends in Missoula and around the world. But until next week, please remember, conservation isn't a spectator sport. Get informed, get engaged, and speak up on behalf of wildlife and wild places.